Welcome to episode 305 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Miranda Barnwell,
Nathan Smith.
And in today's episode, we will be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be joined by Peter Labuza to talk about the 1941 film Hell's a Poppin' as part of our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series. And it's a good chat, so be sure to stick around for that one. But let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. Miranda, I'm going to start with you. You caught a staple of some nice action cinema, some aliens. For whatever reason, I was thinking Joel Schumacher was who just recently died. I thought he was affiliated with this. He's not. I don't know why I was thinking that. Anyway, go ahead and talk about your movie.
Yes. So I just watched Aliens for the first time a few days ago, and I've seen Alien a few times, and I really like it. I love Sigourney Weaver in it, and I like the atmosphere of the first film. And I have heard people talk about, you know, I've heard about Aliens and just kind of how different it is, and I just finally got to it. I watched it with a friend, actually. He really likes it. And I could definitely, I was kind of, I don't know if I should say surprised, because this was done in the late 80s, but just how different it is from the first Alien, and just how kind of different Sigourney Weaver's character is, how different Ripley is. So the premise of the Aliens is that it's been 57 years since Ripley has left the Nostromo, since she's destroyed it, and where they were. And she's been found by her employers, and, you know, they wake her up and they tell her everything that's happened, and, you know, that it's 57 years later. And she tells them about these aliens that they found. They're like, well, that's not possible because we have a whole colony there now. And she's like, well, you should probably not have them there. And then they lose contact with the colony. And so they have to send in a troop of, I guess, like Marines into the colony to check it out. And after, like, just constantly asking her, because she's, you know, traumatized, and rightfully so, from this whole event. They ask her, and she finally says okay to go back with them to this colony and check in on it. And I think, I mean, just to me, like, the biggest thing is, like, it definitely tells an action movie just, like, how central guns are in this movie, which, like, I don't know. Like, I guess just in comparison, like, they do say something in the beginning that Ripley was able to, like, you know, get through and survive, you know, getting off a Nostromo with just a flamethrower. She didn't have, you know, any, you know, assault rifles or anything. And just, I don't know. It was kind of, I guess, uncomfortable. I don't know. Like, the whole kind of, like, the, like, maybe one sort of love scene-ish scene in the movie with her, and that one guy is, like, him showing her how to, like, properly load a gun or whatever. So it's kind of weird. And I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen the first Alien, but I feel like her character in this one is much more maternal in this one. And, you know, with her, because they find a little girl named Newt, and she becomes very, like, you know, not possessive, but she just cares a lot about her and wants her to be okay. So I don't know. It's long. There are a lot of action sequences, and, like, action sequences and car scenes. They can kind of lose me. But, you know, I think I really like the atmosphere of the first Alien. I just like the whole vibe of it, I guess, if we can call it that. So I guess as an action film, like, it does well, but that's just not my thing, I think. I don't know. I'm curious what you two think of the movie, I guess, if that's okay to ask, or if you have any thoughts on it.
I haven't watched it in a long time. The Alien franchise is such a strange franchise. There's something respectable about it, because all of the movies are, like, vastly different. You know, the first one is probably my favorite, but it's, like you said, it's completely different than what they do in the second one, and then the third one's this whole other thing, and then you have, like, the recent ones, like Prometheus and Alien Covenant, with Ridley Scott kind of going back in there, and I guess, like, Can't Let It Go now. where it's such
the mythology.
Exactly. It's so it's like I don't know, there's so many different facets of it, and this one especially just kind of feels a little bit of an outlier from the rest of them, even though they're all so different. I mean, you don't have really a character like the Bill Paxton character in any of the other Alien movies. I don't know. I like it. I know. I can't remember if Andrew detailed this one in his guns essay, you know, to your gun point, but it very much.
That's a great essay, by the way.
You don't have to suck up to him.
No, yeah, it's so good. Sorry, go ahead.
Classic. I don't even like essays.
I just did that since he's listening. But yeah, no, it is. It's like you have like this whole big gun fetish that it's very much not the not what they're going for in the first Alien movie.
Right, and I think my friend actually told me. Tell me if I'm wrong. Well, I'm not wrong. But anyway, the Steadicam actually with that where they have the Steadicam that's holding the assault rifle, like that's actually a thing then that the military was like, oh, that's a good idea. Like, so it's just, I don't know. They're just there. So, yes.
I mean, it's the thing that's like the first movie is about these kind of fucked over, forgotten blue collar workers who are in a terrible situation and they're just like trying to survive, you know, trying to make it to the next day. And it's just like very easy to empathize and sympathize and identify with I think, those characters, both because they're just like, in addition to Sigourney Weaver, of course, you know, who's amazing, but I love the ensemble of the first Alien so much. And like just every character in there is so rich, even if there's not a lot that you know about them, just you feel like, you know, that spaceship and that working dynamic and you know, that environment, you feel like you really get it. And I don't know, at the time when I saw Aliens, I liked it a lot and I thought it was like a fun action movie, but over time it's really faded for me, and I feel like if I were to rewatch it, I may end up even disliking it, because it's just like the second movie is just, it's like it's the army, it's like Empire, it's an invasion, it's not like these people trying to survive. It's like, just maybe just leave the aliens alone at this point, like maybe just stay away from them. I don't
just
know,
let them live. Like,
and the first movie has, you know, all of this like you know, iconic kind of like gross psychosexual imagery and all that, and you know, like you've been saying, the second one just sort of, the first movie is like afraid of sex, and then the second movie is like, you know, horny for guns. It's like it's just a very different, I feel like, the movie's like relationship to like just the bodies and like sexuality and those kind of things are just feel very different, and it feels like this sort of like trying to be a very sort of assertive compensatory masculine movie in a way that like the first one isn't. But I don't know, but it's weird how, like Zach, you said, this franchise keeps sort of evolving and mutating, and like the new ones are all about how human beings are horrible and like deserve to be destroyed. I don't know, it's an interesting franchise to me. But this one definitely, like, it's just a little, it just feels, maybe it's a movie that was like, became, it was sort of prototypical or something, and so watching it now, it maybe seems sort of ordinary, but I also feel like it is a little bit just standard issue. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to pretend like I like all of the Alien franchise movies, but I will admit, it's like, I wish, you know, you look at like the franchises now, whether it's like the Marvel movies or even just like some of the other kind of franchise films that you get, and it's, you know, it's kind of like they have like, this is the mode that we're going to work in, like something like Deadpool, it's like we're going to do the same thing in every movie, and so you're like, at least this one you have one Alien movie that's like this, you get another Alien movie that's, you know, completely different, like it's just, you're getting kind of a mixed bag, but you got, you know, Sigourney Weaver in the middle of it, who cares. So I kind of there's something appreciative about that. Cool. Is that streaming anywhere? I think maybe one of the HBO channels has it.
Yeah, I think it's HBO Go. I know we watched on one of the HBOs, whatever one it is.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Nice. Nathan, you had a movie you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I saw a film that has sort of been, I guess, a little unknown and a little forgotten for a long time. But it's actually it's directed by somebody who is, I think, very recognizable to a lot of people. And that movie is The Killing Floor, which was the feature-length directorial debut of the actor Bill Duke, who's been in, like, so many countless movies. I mean, he's in Predator and Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's an American Gigolo, Menace to Society, so many movies. He just has like an endless resume. And in addition to his prolific career as a character actor, he has a really accomplished filmography as a director too. He's directed dozens and dozens of episodes of television. He's sort of directed a lot of really fantastic crime movies. The movie Deep Cover with Lawrence Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum, which is like this really sort of vivid and evocative neo-noir that's about like the sort of dissonance and disconnect of being a black police officer. He also directed A Rage in Harlem, which is an adaptation of the Chester Himes novel of the same name, which is a sort of lightly comedic detective movie set in Harlem around the middle of the 20th century, a really just amazing period piece. He also directed Sister Act 2, among other movies and various things. But The Killing Floor was his feature-length debut, like I said, and it was actually originally broadcast on television on PBS's American Playhouse. And it was so well-received that it went on to play at the Cannes Film Festival in 1985, and then it won actually a jury prize at Sundance, I think, the same year, which is really interesting. Like a movie, you know, so often movies play festivals and then they don't get a major theatrical release, but they play on PBS or some kind of television. And this is the opposite of that. You know, it's a movie that played on television, premiered on television, and then was well regarded enough to be accepted at festivals. And I can totally see why watching this movie. You know, it does feel very much like a television movie. You know, it's a little bit theatrical, feels a little bit like a stage play at moments. It's also something, it's a topic that you would expect to be portrayed in a very violent manner, I think. But of course, because it's on television, there's only so much they can do and show. Basically, this is about a young guy, a young black man from the South during World War I, who moves up north as part of the Great Migration, trying to find work in the factories and slaughterhouses of Chicago, because, you know, so many white men have left to fight in World War I. There are now all of these open jobs for people who were previously shut out of so many industries. So Heavy goes up to Chicago, and he, you know, he doesn't really know his way around the city. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He gets a job at a slaughterhouse, and he soon, for the first time, finds himself exposed to union organizing. And the union at this time, 1918, is predominantly white. And in fact, they lead the union meetings in Polish because most of the members are Polish or Slavic from Eastern Europe. So there are not very many black men at all in the union. There's only one active black member, and most of the other guys at the slaughterhouse have been sort of burned by the union. You know, they've said, like, you know, every time that we try to work with these white guys, you know, they say, you know, they say solidarity, and they say they're going to look out for us, and then the company tries to cut them some kind of deal that shuts us out. So you really see in this movie, it's like an incredibly nuanced and rich exploration of how racial and ethnic tensions are used to break break up labor unions and break up organizing movements, and how those kind of divisions are used to further divide the working class. And it doesn't just kind of paint, you know, black against white. It gets like very specific into these sort of inter-ethnic tensions that are very specific to Chicago in this time, you know, like the Lithuanians being pitted against the Germans, being pitted against, you know, the Greeks, being pitted against every, you know, new group that comes over, every new immigrant group. every time a new group comes in, they essentially have to start the union over, because every single time the packing company finds some way to turn them everybody against each other. So really you see like this guy is just like, you know, he is really like the kind of the first black union organizer in the meat, I guess the butchers and meat cutters union. And you see him sort of grow as a person and grow as an organizer. And he starts to sort of like grow the membership and reach out to other people who have previously been suspicious of the union. But then everything in Chicago sort of boils over after World War One, once a lot of people have come back from the war, and the race riots explode in the city. And you get this just like, I think, really real sense of like the kind of palpable horror of race riots. You know, you can't see violence, but you hear descriptions of just these kind of horrible things that people are doing to each other. And the way that these race riots not only affect people physically, you know, and the violence that's done to them, but how it also cuts them off from work, because you basically have all of these white goons like patrolling the black neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago and preventing all of the people who live there from going to work. So it's not only affecting everyone physically, and it's affecting them materially and financially and economically. And it's just kind of amazing to me what Bill Duke is able to do with this like 2-hour long TV movie. You know, there are so many topics that are touched on in this movie that I feel like are the kinds of things that like we should be learning about in our history classes, but we're not. You know, like this is like, in an ideal world, I feel like this movie would be shown in an AP US history class. But it's just like, you know, the history of labor and of union organizing in this country is suppressed. The history of race riots and racial violence is suppressed in this country. And so, not to do a little now more than ever, but I do think that this is a really, you know, if you want to watch something that feels a little purposeful right now, this is a great choice. You know, it's like extremely educational, but also like I found it very uplifting and very inspiring. You know, it's not necessarily a happy movie, you know, not everything works out, but I think we know that, you know, that's just sort of the history of unions in this country is unfortunately a lot of things haven't really worked out, and unfortunately that's also the history of racism in this country too, is that just a lot of things are bad. And so it's not necessarily the happiest and lightest film, but I did find it kind of stirring me inside a little bit. And it's also just got like a great cast of like TV actors, like John Mahoney from Frasier and Dennis Farina, you know, just some like great Chicago character actors. You know, Bill Duke, I think honestly is not just a great actor, but I really feel like as the more I go into his filmography, he's kind of an unsung American auteur. I feel like he just makes these small little movies that contain somehow like all of this commentary on so many issues. So this is like, which it was just restored recently by Film Movement, and a lot of art house cinemas around the country are currently showing it in their virtual screening rooms. So you can rent it right now and watch it.
Cool. I've seen Bill Duke's name coming up, you know, as somebody, you know, with Criterion Channel opening up their, you know, library of films with black directors and actors and, you know, subject matter, and then, you know, kind of other places doing that as well. People going, yeah, you should this is a, you know, a nice opportunity to check out some of Bill Duke's work, because it kind of gets overshadowed a lot of the time.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like, you know, people talk a lot about the sort of black new wave, I guess, in American cinema of the 80s and 90s. And that's a lot of times the sort of black filmmakers that people are talking about. But even then, I feel like Bill Duke has been sort of left out of that conversation a little bit and isn't really included. I mean, maybe it's because he was making movies like Sister Act 2 or movies that on their surface seem like relatively straightforward crime thrillers. But I, you know, as we know, I think we know very well, sometimes those, you know, little genre movies can contain the richest worldviews. And Bill Duke's movies are evidence of that, I think.
Absolutely. Very cool. Well, hopefully people will check it out since it's going in art house cinemas, virtual, you know, screenings. That's a nice opportunity to support your local art house theater. So do that as well. Cool. I had two movies. I have a nice double feature of Taxi Driver Mold movie. I didn't plan to watch both of them. They also came out in 2009, but you know, I don't know. It's pure coincidence. The first one I want to talk about, because I think I like this more, is Big Fan. It's directed by Robert Siegel. Like I said, it came out in 2009. It stars Patton Oswalt. He is he's like in his mid to late 30s. He's a parking garage attendant in Staten Island, and pretty much all his focus is that he's a giant New York Giants football fan. Every day he sits like in the parking garage little attendance box thing and is like listening to the sports talk radio. Generally he's listening to a character played by Michael Rapaport, who is a Philadelphia Eagles fan who calls in and just sits there and just, you know, mercilessly just shits on the Giants for however long, you know, as a segment. And Paul, the Patton Oswalt character, sits there and kind of and like works out a script of what he's going to say. And then he goes home later in the day. And while his, you know, his elderly mother is like banging on the wall to tell him to be quiet, he's on the phone with the radio station laying into whatever the Michael Rapaport character said about the Giants that day, and has like this kind of, you know, views himself as like this, you know, Shakespearean monologuist of New York Giants fandom. And he's completely enabled the entire way by his best friend, who's played by Kevin Corrigan, who really enjoying some nice little side roles for Kevin Corrigan. He was also fantastic in his small role in Unstoppable, but he kind of has
he's somebody who I feel like I never know is in a movie going into it, and then I'm always like happy to see him.
Exactly. And so that's what he's kind of, you know, he definitely has that kind of Arrested Development mentality that the Patton Oswalt character has in this movie, but there's something a little bit more empathetic about him, and it might just be because I like Kevin Corrigan and I was happy to see him. But pretty much the crux of the movie is they're out at a gas station one night after hanging out, and they see the star linebacker for the New York Giants, who in the movie is called Quantrell Bishop, and they decide to follow him, and they follow him into Manhattan, and he goes into a strip club, and the two of them have like this, there's kind of this long sequence where they're just awkwardly sitting in the strip club trying to figure out how to interact with this, you know, this kind of larger than life figure, because he very much is the, you know, point of affection for Paul, the Patton Oswalt character. I mean, he has like a giant poster of him like above his bed, and he finally like works up the nerve to go and talk to him, and he's talking to him, and then he just kind of, you know, they start kind of fumbling in, you know, what they're talking about, and they accidentally let slip that they saw them going into this house out on Staten Island after they went to the gas station. And so the Quantrell Bishop is kind of like, are you following us? And things escalate. And then he, the, you know, the, of course, the linebacker just starts beating the shit out of Patton Oswalt's character. And the next thing we know, it's cut, you know, it cuts and he's in the hospital, and he has his brother, his older brother, who is a lawyer, who's kind of breaking down what's happened. Quantrell Bishop has been suspended. There's an investigation. There's a police detective who's coming, and it kind of has like this really seedy underbelly to it, because you have this detective who is pretty clear that he's like, yeah, I'm trying to take down this star football player, this star African-American football player. And you kind of get the same thing from the brother, who's just like, no, screw this asshole. He's just some, you know, millionaire football player who we're going to take down, who did this to you. And the interesting thing about the story is that Paul will just not relent. Like, he's just like, no, it was a complete misunderstanding. He's not going to do anything about it. But at the same time, because an investigation is happening, the Quantrell Bishop is continuously suspended throughout the season. And so the Giants are losing games, and that's depressing Paul more than like the state of, you know, his health and well-being. And so finally, Bishop comes back, and they still lose the game. And so, for the final game of the season, he's back, and Paul continues to get worked up at the Michael Rapaport character, who continues to call into the New York show. And so he decides to steal his mom's car and drive all the way to Philadelphia and confront him. And so he, like, you kind of have like the Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver scene where he shaves his head and is doing the "you talking to me" in the mirror, but it's Patton Oswalt putting on green, you know, dark green paint for the Eagles. And he goes into this Philadelphia bar, and he finds the Michael Rapaport character. And I'll go ahead and spoil the movie, because I mean, I think it's still worth checking out, even if you know kind of what happens. But rather than it being like something like Taxi Driver, where you have like this illustrious shootout, but it kind of gets, then you go into like that dream logic that the movie kind of ends in. This one, you have Patton Oswalt, you know, holding a gun to the Michael Rapaport character in this bathroom, and he starts firing it, and Robert's Siegel, like, you know, kind of edit, they edit the sequence like you think he's just, you know, completely mowing him down. And then they kind of pan down, and you see that he's been shooting him with a paintball gun. And then Patton Oswalt just kind of books it out of the place. And the movie ends with him getting prepped for the Giants season with Kevin Corrigan while he's in prison. And to me, it was kind of just like an interesting break off of the whole, you know, the Taxi Driver mold is like this. It's kind of like everything is spiraling into this completely ultra violent ending. And this one, it kind of showed just how sad and pathetic, you know, these just uber fan, and not just in sports, but just in anything, people, you know, these people who just worship these totems of pop culture, because at the end of the day, they don't really have much. They don't really have anything. And so even when he has this opportunity to like perform this really vicious act, and like, and even though he, you know, it's you don't want him to like kill somebody, like at least he's doing something in his life, he still is, you know, he just shoots him with a paintball gun and completely doesn't take anything away from all that he's been dealing with for the last, you know, few months, and is still just infatuated with what the Giants are going to be doing the next year at the very end of the movie. And so it was kind of just a fascinating movie to me. It was just fascinating in that point that it kind of went in that direction rather than kind of following in the Taxi Driver mold, which is kind of in line. I mean, it's a similar thing with the other movie that I watched, which is Observe and Report, which is directed by Jody Hill, who I'm a big fan of from Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals and the The Righteous Gemstones, yeah, the Danny McBride series that he's done for HBO. He's also had a couple. I'll botch his movies, but he's done a number of movies. He did The Foot Fist Way,
The Legacy of a White-Tailed Deer Hunter.
I need to watch that one. The Foot Fist Way I liked a lot. It was kind of like it felt very much in the Napoleon Dynamite mold of comedies.
Yeah. They those dudes have credited Napoleon Dynamite as a huge influence, and it makes so much sense to me. Even in Observe and Report a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it does have like that, it very much has like that, it has that vibe to it, because I was talking with somebody about it, and they were saying that they kind of looped it in with like the Apatow comedies of this time because of Seth Rogen, and you kind of have some of those outside of Rogen, you have people who you would kind of assume would be in Apatow movies, like Anna Faris and Michael Pena, and Aziz Ansari has like a very small role in this. And ironically, I mean, you have Danny McBride shows up in it, and ironically enough, you also have Patton Oswalt in this movie. But I think that this movie is trying to say a lot more than any Apatow movie really has ever tried to say. But also it kind of has this semi interesting view on the taxi driver mold. So Seth Rogen plays this mall cop, which also I think this came out around the same time as Paul Blart. So you had this mall cop.
Yeah, they came out the same year.
You have this like mall cop movie fascination, but he decides.
I actually think that they Jody Hill and company accused Kevin James of like ripping them off.
I mean, this one I think is probably more interesting. So Seth Rogen's mall cop character, they have a flasher who is running around the mall parking lot flashing women. And so he decides to kind of make this like his big case. And when he's unable to bring the flasher to justice initially, they call in the police, specifically a detective played by Ray Liotta. The Ronnie, the Seth Rogen character, kind of becomes infatuated with taking pretty much his mall copness to the next level, and enrolls in the police academy, and gets, you know, flying colors for all of the physical things and everything in all of that training, but then completely flunks the mental exam when he's he pretty much talks about how he is excited to be a cop, to bring, you know, to wield weapons and bring people to justice and take down anybody who he feels like is doing wrong. And you have like this prolonged sequence prior to that where Ray Liotta is taking him on kind of a ride around, and he drops him off in this one neighborhood of town, and you have the Danny McBride, the character that Danny McBride's playing, who shows up, and Seth Rogen beats up all these people with just kind of this, it's not really like this precise action-based violence, it's just like this... you know, he kind of just works off of this untethered rage and just starts kind of beating all of them senselessly, and drags this one kid back to the police station. And he just kind of has this infatuation with, you know, beating people to a pulp of their life and then bringing them to justice in that way. And so it's kind of playing with that concept of like, he fits every bit of like the mold of what you would assume that cops would want, is this guy who is very gung-ho about, you know, serving justice, but also you know, is trained enough that he can exert violence on the perpetrators. But at the same time, like, this movie kind of has like this interesting mindset of, I mean, it pretty much ends with the Seth Rogen character flipping off all of the cops at the police station and walking off and just deciding to, I guess, be a mall cop. But at the same time, you have like this very, you know, the kind of come to head violent end moment where he finds the flasher and just like shoots him in like the shoulder, and you like have this kind of like really violent bloody sequence where the guy has this gap, you know, this giant hole in his shoulder, and he drags him to the police station. So I don't know, I never felt like it completely came together. It kind of has like this weird you know, it's definitely on that level of Taxi Driver and kind of playing off of what people, you know, assume with like the Apatow comedies in the kind of those movies of the time. But I also find it kind of interesting because I think that both of these movies like update the Taxi Driver mold in a way that that feels like natural for the 21st century. You know, there is something that feels a little bit, there's something that I think with Taxi Driver that you can watch and feel like it relates to today. But also I think a lot of it is a little bit dated just in terms of how culture and society have shifted to a degree and really like, the commodification of just kind of, you know, there's something about the mall and these mega sports organizations that feels much more in tune with what people would be, you know, infatuated with rather than, you know, anything that the De Niro character is getting into in Taxi Driver. And so Observe and Report right now is on Netflix and Big Fan is on Canopy. I think they're both kind of interesting in their own ways. Nathan, I think you've seen one of these or both of these. I mean, do you have anything to add on either movie?
I've seen both of them. Big Fan, I don't really remember a whole lot about. I think I saw it like on the IFC channel years ago. Observe and Report is interesting, but I feel like the television work of Jody Hill and co. is a lot more effective for me. And I mean, I feel like to me, Eastbound and Down is kind of cinema. but I feel like there's something about Observe and Report that would just like, you could change nothing else about the movie, but cast Danny McBride in the Seth Rogen role. And it just makes a lot more sense and works a lot more to me. There's just like something about Seth Rogen where, of course, you know, he plays so often the like Apatow man-child, but I feel like his kind of man-childness is something different and isn't quite what this character needs, like, because this guy is like genuinely like a psychopath, you know, like he's somebody.
Well, there's this delusion to it. There's this, you know, Danny McBride's able to kind of like thread that line of being like, you go along with his character in like Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals, but you also see how like hopelessly delusional he is to the entire situation.
Yeah, and there's like a real sadness to Danny McBride's affect that I feel like Seth Rogen is like, he can play a pathetic character, but I don't think he can really play a character that you genuinely like, you see them do terrible things, but you also like feel some kind of sadness for them because like you just know that they're just like a totally fucked up person. Like, I don't know, you know, there's just something about Seth Rogen where I just, he feels a little too regular almost, like he not in a regular, like the kind of guy who would be a mall cop way. He just feels like, I don't know, he feels like too white collar, maybe. Like, he feels like Seth Rogen should be playing a guy who works in an office. So I don't know. I mean, I also think that if I were to watch this movie again, it's been a number of years, I feel like I might feel even weirder about it than I did in like 2013 or whenever I saw it. Just with everything kind of going on in the world. And I also just remember there being some gags that I feel like hadn't really aged great, even a few years after it had come out.
No, I absolutely agree with your point that I think it's an interesting movie on itself, but it's not perfect. And I think it would have been better with Danny McBride because there's just something about that partnership with Jody Hill that absolutely works. I mean, you look at like a character like Kenny Powers in Eastbound and Down, and he's a pretty reprehensible character the entire time, for the most part. But there's something that at least engages you with it, or even just I forgot what his name, but the Walton Goggins character in Vice Principals, really he should have just got Walton Goggins and Danny McBride to do this movie because those two Those two get it. So.
Oh yeah, they're on another level.
So, but it's not. It's a weirdly prescient movie. I would recommend maybe checking it out now. Because it's not. It's not necessarily pro police. As you would think.
For sure.
But you know, I think Jody Hill's a kind of interesting mind. He seems to understand. His movies seem kind of. This one I was like, eh. I liked Foot Fist Way a lot. I'll be curious to watch the other one. I think it's on Netflix. But if you've not watched his TV shows, guys, I mean, those things are masterpieces. All right, we're gonna take a short break. We'll be back with Peter Labuza talking about Hell's a Poppin' after this. Hello, Cinematary. This is Zach, your host, and I'm going to use this midpoint in this week's episode to let you know a little bit about what's happening on both the website and the podcast. So first off, I know for a very long time we asked you not to give us any money. Well, things have changed. We want that money. I'm just kidding. We just want like $5 a month for the rest of your life. But we're doing a Patreon, and I promise this is all in good fun. Patreon.com/cinematary. I'm sure you've heard us mention it at the end of the episode. We are doing this in order to pay for our writing that is happening on the website. We have a wonderful breadth of writers who are all giving a lot of time and effort to come up with reviews and share their thoughts on the website. And so we wanted to just give back to them in that way. And so that is why we created our Patreon page. So again, for $5 a month, you can get exclusive content from the staff. Right now we have our hit series Film Theory and Chill, which takes a piece of film theory each month and then deconstructs it in a way that makes it a little bit more accessible. And then we end that episode usually with just us rambling about whatever is on our mind at that period of time. It's for some people, I guess. But you can find that on patreon.com/cinematary. Please consider, you know, making that donation each month just to help show these writers your appreciation for what they do. Another easy way to kind of keep up with what's happening on Cinematary is signing up for our free newsletter. So if you missed an episode, if you weren't paying attention to social media and you missed maybe a review or something, or a video essay or something that we posted, this is an easy way to keep up with all of that. So each Sunday we send out a note. It goes straight to your inbox. It gives you the latest podcast episodes, you know, what's happening on the Patreon page, and the last two reviews that are on cinematary.com. This is a great way to keep up with what's happening, and it's a nice way if you forget to go, oh, hey, I'm not, you know, just chilling out on a Sunday. I'm having some coffee, doing Sunday things. Here, I'm going to check out what Andrew wrote about something, or what Nathan wrote about something. Just, you know, we got that stuff going. So you can find that on the website, cinematary.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. Again, it's free. And finally, the easiest way to support this show is to go on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and review. You know, this is just how the algorithms work. I know every show asks you to do this, but honestly, if you could take, 30 seconds to a minute and do this, it would greatly, you know, help us. I mean, this helps us just as much as, you know, signing up for the Patreon or letting people know on social media that you listen to Cinematary and you enjoy it. All of that stuff is very helpful, So give us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast, and, you know, share it on social media. Let people know that Cinematary is around. So again, consider donating to Patreon. That's patreon.com/cinematary. Sign up for the free newsletter and then give us a rating and review on your podcaster app. Well, that is way too much of me talking. You're about to hear more of me talking, so I apologize in advance, but thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show.
I feel a rhythmic brainstorm coming on. One, two, keep that rhythm heating. One more riff like that and I'll be gone. Oh man, don't stop now, we're jumping. Give everything to Lord now. This thing might turn into something. I ain't mistaken, here comes something now.
Part 2 of episode 305 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1941's Hell's a Poppin'. And joining us today, the host of the Cinephiliacs, Peter Labuza. Peter, thank you so much for joining the podcast and talking about this.
Yeah, first time listener, or long time listener, first time caller, I guess. It's good to be here.
Very good. Well, I usually kind of do an intro sheet on the movie, and quite honestly, I did some kind of just basic, you know, Google researching on this movie, and there's not much out there. It seems to be somewhat of a kind of lost movie, and we can kind of get into that a little bit, you know, in this chat, but I kind of wanted to just start with everybody's kind of impression of this, because this was my first time watching this. This has been one that, Nathan, I think you have placed on the ballot for Young Critics the last like 2 to 3 years. You've been pushing it. I don't know, like it just kind of finally hit, and I'm very glad that you did, because this was absolutely bonkers fun. I loved every second of this movie. And so, Peter, I know that you've seen this a number of times. So I guess tell us a little bit about your experience with this movie. And then I'm also, you know, curious to hear about your girlfriend, who you made watch made her watch this for the very first time recently. And I'm curious what her reaction to this was as somebody else who was doing this for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this, and I saw this first through someone Nathan knows quite well, Rob King, who teaches at Columbia University and a scholar of labor and comedy. He showed this in one of his comedy seminars, and like it just kind of absolutely blew me away, partially because of the lack of knowledge I knew about the film going in, and that this sort of extremely fourth wall breaking film and everything that it does to sort of disrupt the way we think about what the limitations of Hollywood are. So it kind of blew me away at that first time. And then I've seen it subsequent times. The most special was a secret screening at the University of California, Los Angeles, put on by a friend, Harry Eskin. That was a Nitrate print of the film. Incredible to see, you know. I mean, not that Hell's a Poppin' is, say, something shot like Powell and Pressburger films or, you know, classics of film noir, but to see it in that sort of high quality 35 millimeter Nitrate print was just the most special. And then I've seen it a couple more times since then, most recently last Friday, and it was the film of the night for my partner and I, my girlfriend, and we watch a lot of classical Hollywood films, a lot of pre-codes and stuff, and, you know, she's seen quite a film, a few films from this era, and I was saying, well, we have to watch Hell's a Poppin'. She's like, okay, well, tell me who's in it, what's in the plot. I'm like, no, I can't tell you anything about Hell's a Poppin'. All I can say is it's Hell's a Poppin', and it's insane, and that's it. That's all you have to see. And so she absolutely loved it, of course, because, like, how does one hate Hell's a Poppin'? It is just such a unique work, and nothing can prepare you to experience a film in which you might know, if you, the only things you know is 1941 Universal Studios comedy, like that gives you a certain sense of like a certain set of films you might be familiar with, but none of them can compare in any way or shape or form to what Hell's a Poppin' is.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, as somebody who watched it for the first time, I mean, I knew there was going to be that it was going to be somewhat insane, and really the first, what is it, the first 20 minutes or so when they're in the hell set, and it's like part production of the movie slash the stage production of the movie slash just like natural hellscape. I don't even know like how to describe that, because there's so many different things happening, and they're throwing so many, you know, so many jokes and so many bits at you. I mean, I Michael O'Malley, who's, you know, a frequent participant on the podcast, compared it to kind of, you know, you have that kind of Marx Brothers side of it, but also you have that kind of Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, you know, cartoon side to it. And that's kind of a good, you know, baseline to kind of understand, because I mean, there's just stuff being tossed at you, and quite honestly, you can't laugh at it all because it's coming so quickly, and it's coming out of so many different places that you're not really able to process it as it's coming in. Nathan, as the person who nominated this, I'm curious what your history with Hell's a Poppin' is.
Well, this was actually my first time seeing it, but it's been something that I've just perpetually been intending to get around to. And so part of the reason why I was sort of like championing this movie for so long and nominating it every time we do this series is because I know that it was like super beloved and influential by Joe Dante, and you know, a filmmaker of similarly anarchic and I think absurd and insane movies that really defy description and just have like a gag a minute, even, you know, maybe more than a gag a minute, more like a gag a second, I think, in the case of Hell's a Poppin' and in the case of something, you know, like Gremlins 2. And so I think that this movie, even though, like you mentioned, is this sort of both a sort of unknown movie that people maybe just, you know, it's not really like in the recognized canon, I guess, in terms of the movies that people consider of this era. You know, it's this sort of like hidden classic. But it has a long influence, I think, despite that sort of lack of a really strong identifiable reputation, just because of that Looney Tunishness, you know, because of the way that it uses so many visual effects and in-camera effects and just, you know, tricks of montage and superimposition in a way that I feel like we're not really used to seeing so excessively in a movie from this era. And also we're not used to seeing it used like in the context of human beings. You know, I feel like so many of the techniques used in this movie are things that are generally left to the realm of animation, or at least that's the way that we think about this kind of filmmaking. But it just really, like, I don't know, it just does, it's got a like relationship to how the human body is filmed and captured that I feel like is really it's both in keeping with a lot of films from this time, but it's also like really unique and a really accelerated version of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Miranda, as somebody who's seen you know, kind of is a connoisseur of these Hollywood pre-code and code movies, and just somebody who's watching movies of this era, I mean, as somebody who saw this for the first time, what did you make of it? And had you seen anything like it from this era before?
So I will give like kind of my background to this, actually, because I had heard of this title. I've known about it for a few years now, and it was when I was inspecting it as a film student, a film archivist student. And I remember asking one of my teachers about it, and I said, you know, I've never heard of this. And he's like, well, I think there's some copyright issues with it. So I just, you know, I remember what struck me was the title. And I remember telling my classmates about it later, I think that week. And I was like a little bit in a, not a drunken stupor, but, you know, kind of like having a nice time. And I told everybody about this film we were inspecting, that I was inspecting. And I was like, and I kid you not, the title is called Hell's a Palooza. And everybody was like, that is not the title. So it's been like kind of, it's been on my mind for a few years. And I remember, like, you know, there's a copy of a DVD I saw, and I didn't recognize any of the actors. And I was like, well, maybe someday. And then when you guys had it on your ballot for Young Critics, I was actually really interested in watching it. And I haven't seen anything like this before. And I think tying it also to, you know, the Marx Brothers, but also the cartoons of Tex Avery is actually really, it's a perfect description. Because I thought a lot about like that breaking the fourth wall and like talking to the audience that you see in a lot of maybe like cartoons in general, but I think of Tex Avery specifically. And what struck me was just like this, the projectionist and the characters in the film talking so outright about the Hays Code and bringing up censored. I was like, so it's very much in this realm of like, you know, kind of absurdist comedy, whatever, but also like, not necessarily like limited to animation, but like we're also in the real world, like, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Well, it's weird to think of this because it originated as a Broadway play, and you know, I'm sure you can still have those effective fourth wall breaking moments on a theater stage, but there's something about and you know, this is maybe it's not the right way to describe it, but this is a very like 3D movie. Like it's it never feels like it's just like kind of living on whatever film strip plane it's on. It feels like it's almost like reaching out at you constantly, and that's something I didn't even in like Marx Brothers movies, I never feel that necessarily.
No, I agree. That's actually a good way to put it. Like I remember thinking in the beginning, and you mentioned this, where it's like that first 20 minutes where you're like in that like hellscape, and then like the side, like the, you know, the cameras and everybody's shooting that, and then you go off into these other sets. Like there's no sense of just a room on its own, and then there's like a door you walk to another one. It's like all in just this like continuous, like it almost kind of reminded me of in A Duck Amuck, when Daffy Duck just keeps walking through to different areas and he's expecting one thing, and you know, like, you know, maybe he's gonna start skiing and he's actually in a, you know, a sunny beach or something. But yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, it is. It does feel like very like three dimensional. That's a good
point. Yeah, it feels like constantly. They're not even just working on the, I mean, and they kind of play around with that in the movie, because they're not even playing on the strip of film that they're on. They're also, you know, talking to, is it Louis the projectionist?
Projectionist, yeah.
Yeah, they're like talking to him throughout the movie. They're also, you know, they also kind of have that duck amuck scene where the strip kind of gets split, and you have like the top half and the bottom half, and so it constantly feels like it's not working within the realm of the movie, of just a motion picture in general, and it's pretty upfront about that. And I'll be honest, I don't know too much about is it Olsen and Johnson, the two main actors in it, but there's something really just kind of elastic about the way that they go about this movie. I mean, you have they make reference of it, but there's a plot in place, but there's almost like this contempt for the plot. And I haven't seen Gremlins 2, Nathan, but I know that that's kind of, you bring up the comparison to Joe Dante, but like that almost contempt for the plot that they're, you know, doing seems to be something that also is prevalent in that movie.
Well, I feel like in this movie, there's a sort of, sometimes even a contempt for the actors too. And that's not a bad thing. Like it's just wants to subject everyone on screen to the most, absurd possible series of events, and it's just constantly humiliating these people, and so it's just it feels like what unites this with the, you know, the cartoons of Tex Avery and Chuck Jones, what unites it with Joe Dante and the Gremlins movies, is that I think seeing film not as a mechanism to engineer plot, but to engineer moments, you know, and like single images and single sensations. In a weird way, I feel like it's, you know, it's a movie from the 1940s, but it feels like it has that such a strong vaudeville sensibility. But it also feels like it very much a piece with a lot of early cinema and how it's like trying to elicit this just same reaction from you over and over again. Just like every moment is an opportunity for some kind of laugh, some kind of gag, some kind of incident, and it's just a like pure machine for generating feeling in the audience, regardless of like any kind of clear narrative, because it just throws you in. You know, there's nothing really to ground yourself beyond, I think, the medium specificity, beyond the sort of references to movies and the sort of the nature of the medium. That's really what ground yourself in as a viewer, not the plot or the narrative.
Well, it also, I think one of the things that's so interesting is that it kind of trusts the viewer to be so familiar with what's going on in a larger, broader cultural sense at the time. I mean, The Hells of Poppin', I believe, had run for 3 years on Broadway before this. And like the one kind of continuous element of it. It was constantly changing. I've heard like it used to open with like FDR and Hitler speeches with like fake voiceovers that like made Hitler speak in Yiddish. But like part of it was that it was going to be this audience interaction, constantly changing, fourth wall breaking element. There's a few of the quote unquote recycled plots that do appear in the film. One being this guy who keeps calling out for Mrs. Jones, and has a tree with him that grows throughout the film, which was a part of the original Broadway play, where as audiences left, you had a giant tree in the lobby that had taken over, and the guy is still calling for Mrs. Jones. And then, of course, we see that here. But even, of course, many people reference that the film spoils the ending to Citizen Kane when they're walking around the movie lot, and you see the rosebud, sled there, and he says, "I had burned this." Of course, they use the actor Misha Auer, who, if people I think are most familiar from his role in My Man Godfrey, but often played these roles where he faked being an aristocrat, essentially, in a lot of films from the late 30s. He sort of has this sort of Russian look to him, and so he would be this person who appears to be an aristocrat and then turns out to be fake. In this film, of course, it flips that, right? Is that our character is... Everyone believes that he's just pretending to be an aristocrat, but he actually is an aristocrat. So it kind of plays into like an audience familiarity with these actors, with this style, with like knowing who Slim and Slam are, the people who kind of work with the Lindy Hop dancers in one sequence. And there's this kind of constant, and I think this is why the film did okay, I believe, in the box office, if I recall, but was not particular, is because it required people to be so familiar with all these objects of culture and history at the time. I guess like culture at the time, now historical culture, but and unless you were part of the New York LA scene, like you may have not been, you know, privy to that as much. Though Hell's a Poppin' did go on the road, I believe, in 1942, and so they were going to quite a lot of cities after the film was made.
Do you know, I mean, I know you mentioned, in a Letterboxd review, you know, you mentioned Mel Brooks, and I saw a lot of other people kind of compare this to like Mel Brooks or the movie Airplane or something of that nature. I mean, is this a movie that kind of had, at least to your knowledge, like a, you know, it stuck with a lot of filmmakers? It had like an influence on people, or did it, because it kind of got lost, is it one that, you know, people like us are just kind of finding it? Didn't necessarily kind of latch on with upcoming filmmakers at that time?
I think Miranda mentioned there is a copyright issue, and this is why the film's never been like officially released on DVD in the United States. I am not clear what that copyright issue is. I do believe that it did play more in, say, experimental film venues in sort of starting in the 50s and 60s. And so I am sure, I've never read, like Joe Dante mentioned this, but I would be shocked if he didn't. I know that the Robert Altman film Corn's a Poppin', the title of it is a direct reference to Hell's a Poppin'. And then if I can tell one story I know specifically, and I heard this from the great programmer from New York, Nellie Killian, is that Ken Jacobs is the biggest fan of Hell's a Poppin', the avant-garde filmmaker. And apparently he was going to Germany for a semester, I guess, to, I think, teach a couple classes in experimental filmmaking, you know, that kind of sort of thing. And he refused to leave America without his 16mm print of Hell's a Poppin', because Hell's a Poppin' meant so much for him. But lo and behold, as he got to this small town in Germany, right across from where he was staying, there was a theater that was playing Hell's a Poppin' 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, oh, clearly absolutely apocryphal, but it also kind of speaks to like the way that Hell's a Poppin' as a sort of sacred cinephile object, which I'm sure all of us watched in ways that I mean now it's appeared on YouTube, so it kind of feels like it's out there, and obviously the YouTube copy is not legally up there following United States copyright standards, whatever we think of those. But right, it's like it's this object that you can't find on the Criterion Channel. TCM can't play, all for these rights reasons. So it kind of becomes a secret handshake between cinephiles, as certain objects in cinephile history certainly have done.
Sure. I don't know. Now, I don't know if this is true. I saw it just poking around, I think, on Letterboxd reviews and such. But, and this might just be the rumor, but I saw that the copyright is tied up because of something related to Jerry Lewis's lawyer's estate, which the fact that it would be tied up with Jerry Lewis, like, kind of makes sense. I could see why Jerry Lewis would have some, you know, interest in a movie like this. But again, I don't know if that's true or not. It just, it was kind of interesting that the rumor was the copyright was tied up in his lawyer's estate or whatever. And that's why nobody's got around to buying it or whatever.
I will say Jerry Lewis did appear in a 1970s. I forget if it was the 1970s or earlier, but they've revived Hell's a Poppin' various times. I believe you can listen to the 1975 Halloween special they did, and which is supposed to be really good. But Jerry Lewis did appear in Hell's a Poppin', the Broadway show, at some point. So that might make sense of how rights were transferred to him at some point.
Yeah. No, it would make sense. And it like, I mean, that this seems like something that just from watching a number of Jerry Lewis's, especially his slapstick movies, I mean, this seems very much in line, even though this does kind of take it up a level. The one actress I'd like to talk about is Martha Ray, who I saw one Letterboxd review that just referred to her as, that said Martha Ray is Bugs Bunny, which is very true. She just has like this, I mean, Olsen and Johnson are kind of moving at such a fast pace around this movie that you can never really catch them. But Martha Ray seems like, you know, every time she hits the screen, she, you know, absolutely just kind of takes it over. Miranda, what did you make of her performance? Because she just kind of becomes this ray of comedic light whenever she's on screen.
I thought she was wonderful. I really enjoyed her performance, and that was, I thought she was quite funny, and she was definitely the highlight for me. I don't know if I have too much else to say. I don't, or if you guys want to talk first, but.
Well, I love just, I mean, you have that kind of basic structure of her chasing the aristocratic character that Peter was talking about, and it is this very kind of Looney Tunes, Pepe Le Pew kind of setup, but I also just feel like she feels like a character that kind of embodies the cartoon spirit of this movie just through her acting, like the outfits that she wears, the way that she, you know, responds in lines. Like she kind of responds in this exaggerated fashion. She has just these boisterous outfits. She really does kind of embody this cartoon look to her. I mean, did anybody else kind of feel that way while watching her performance?
Yeah, it's so funny because I, you know, seeing her, she feels so familiar in so many different comedy tropes of women who followed in her footsteps. And now I'm going to blank on names to think of, but the one that actually kind of most speaks to me is the Jenna Maroney character in 30 Rock. I feel like there is like a long history of affinity in that way. And it's so funny because I've seen... The only other film I've seen her in is the Charlie Chaplin film Monsieur Verdoux, which I haven't seen in years, so I don't even recall her in it. And she only appeared in so many films before she came more famous on television, I believe. But yes, that energy she brings is so big and so energetic, and it makes even these sort of the songs that she do, which aren't like, you know, necessarily the most spectacular numbers in any ways, but she brings so much life to them. So like the song, I forget exactly where it's like the punchline of each end of the verses song is, "Will you get out of the way?" And someone kind of appears right in front of her face and she smashes them out of the screen. It's just one of those like great bits where I think a lesser actress, it wouldn't feel as authentic or feel more natural. And what she does is she kind of has these strong staccato notes in the way that she moves her body. And I think that's where you get that sort of Looney Tunes sense.
I feel like a lot of times, you know, the sort of as the genre of the movie changes from moment to moment and scene to scene, a lot of times that sort of mutation of the movie is dependent on her performance, because it, you know, in one scene she's doing a very sort of classical, almost Judy Garlandish, you know, musical performance, and then in the next she's doing, you know, getting into all of these wacky, extremely physical vaudevillian hijinks. So it really asks a lot of her as a performer, and I think a lot of the movie is really sort of dependent upon what she does. And like you were saying, you know, also the sort of the style and tenor of the movie changes based on her outfits and her appearance. And if I don't know, she has a performance style that feels it feels very of the time in a way that, like, you know, I don't know, it just, I guess she's just a, like, for lack of a better phrase, she's just like, seems like the classic kind of embodiment of like a like mouthy broad, you know, like in that great old Hollywood way of like, she can just do like anything and everything, and is just like this totally capable, effortless performer, and you can tell that she's just had a like lifetime of performance training, and that all of this is just like, I mean, that's why I think she's so capable of like being clumsy, and you know, at the end when everything's going haywire and everything's going falling apart during the final performance, and she's sort of slipping and tumbling and messing up her marks and all of that. I think the reason why she's able to be so effectively clumsy is because she is so in control of her body, you know, because she's such a talented performer.
Well, she's so in control of everything. I mean, your description, like the nosy broad kind of stereotype, like absolutely, but she also kind of like supersedes that because she's very much in control of everything. And that's even, you know, and she kind of feels like, even though she would be, you know, the stereotype or the crux, you know, that you could kind of lean on would be that she's the secondary character. She kind of, you know, wills herself up to being the lead character at times. You know, she, you think of like her outside at that, you know, that lavish pool party, and she's just kind of bouncing around that place, chasing people and yelling at people and completely owning the screen. It's, you know, it's a performance that you feel like, at least after I watched it, I was like, how did, you know, they not hand over like a bounty of comedies to her afterwards, because she just completely owns the, you know, owns every scene that she's in, and like you said, completely like directs the where the movie's going by the end of it.
Well, I was just like perusing her Wikipedia page.
It's kind of wild.
And apparently, yeah, apparently she was an honorary Green Beret, and she was like a licensed nurse. So in Vietnam, you know, because she had like, of course, it makes so much sense that she'd like performed, you know, during the war and stuff for soldiers. Like, she just seems totally like that kind of performer. But apparently during Vietnam, instead of performing, she like actually worked as a nurse in hospitals, which is kind of wild.
That's crazy. And I see that, I mean, she worked with, you know, W.C. Fields, Abbott and Costello, Peter mentioned Charlie Chaplin. You know, it makes a lot of sense because she does just have like this.
That makes a lot of sense.
This crazy, I like this crazy energy. Now I'm looking at it. She was in the Warner Brothers cartoon, The Woods Are Full of Cuckoos, in 1937. She was caricatured as a jazzy scat singing donkey named Martha Bray, which.
And that's a Frank Tashlin directed cartoon.
That's amazing.
So, it's sort of the, you know, again, the tradition, right, of Hell's a Poppin' to these Tex Avery, Frank Tashlin cartoons, to Jerry Lewis, to Joe Dante, and so on.
And so I guess maybe that's kind of the answer to my earlier question, is it seems like this is a movie that, Peter, as you described, kind of is in that, in the waves of just kind of cinephilia, and maybe doesn't have that wide recognition because of its distribution issues, but is clearly something that has an influence throughout kind of the slapstick comedy as it moved along in the eras, because I agree, there's just no way that somebody like a Joe Dante or a Mel Brooks, or, you know, would not have at least a reference point to this, because there's so many elements in this that you see in a lot of their movies.
And I think one thing that's interesting, and Nathan, I think, was kind of getting at this, that it does have so much of these traditions kind of tied into it. I mean, not to bring up Rob again, but Rob King's book, Hokum, which is kind of about the 1930s sort of transition from silent slapstick comedy through the sound era and the slow kind of devolution of slapstick comedy in place of, say, the screwball romance in a way. One of the things he's talking about is this way that comedy is becoming old-fashioned at this time. And you can already kind of see this in 1941 where, like, with In Hell's a Poppin', where, of course, you get, like, you know, the music cues when, like, someone pratfalls in something, right? Like, that's starting to be seen already by the mid-30s as something that's more aimed at children, less sophisticated, et cetera, compared to, say, like, the bringing up babies of the world, the screwballs, which are more elegant in a way. And I think there's something about Hell's a Poppin' by reviving that anarchic spirit and especially placing it alongside this narrative, which could be the basis of a screwball comedy, right? Rich people's theater troupe need to get the money. Boy loves girl, but needs to make it on his own. Like, there's another person in the way. Like, all that stuff is like a screwball comedy plot. And it's kind of thrown away by saying, well, maybe the funnier thing is this sort of broader slapstick. And I think it's this kind of tradition, kind of this call out of like what Hollywood values and represents. I think this is most valued, of course, in I think what is actually like the most stunning sequence, which is the Lindy Hop sequence, where we're first introduced to Slim and Slam, who are bringing in instruments and they kind of just pick them up and start playing. And these shots you get of all these African-American performers who are going to, we don't know that they're the dancers at the Lindy Hop, but we sort of see them in these roles that are so traditional for African-Americans in classical Hollywood, you know, they're background players as maids, as, you know, butlers, etc. And they hear the music and they all crowd and come to this one space and perform what is arguably like the most amazing dance sequence there is in any Hollywood film. It's just like the athleticism and the choreography is just like on this different level. And as soon as they're discovered by Ole and Johnson, of course, they all scramble away and go back to, you know, the background of the film. But it's sort of the suggestion of, like, what has Hollywood been missing by not putting these people front and center? And, of course, there's no, like, you know, call out, like, oh, Hollywood needs to do this. It's just kind of subtly hinted by the, you know, the bravura of the performance.
Well, there's the throwaway line of like, what is it? They say, why aren't they in the show? And they go, ah, we'll get them for the next one.
I mean, there's so much in the movie that I feel like is building off of that, Peter. I feel like a lot of this movie just brings back this kind of urges and repressed feelings that were sort of pushed to the side during the Code era. And in addition to, you know, that sort of reminder of like how many people are not on the screen in Hollywood film, you just have this general, I think, you know, pointing out the like existence of the Hays Code feels like a pre-Code sort of move, you know. It feels like the sort of subversiveness that we're not really used to in the Code era in that same way. And it feels like this whole movie is like all of these like ways that film can exist and film can be sort of presented to us, you know, all of these possibilities that Hollywood hasn't explored are being shown to us once again in like very rapid succession.
Well, it also shows just like the limitations that kind of story and plot have on those players, because it's like you have this, you know, very basic story structure of, you know, like Peter described, the boy, you know, boy meets girl, but he can't, you know, afford it, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, you have this very cliched plot. And it's like that structure though is that's the Hollywood plot that you're going to get in each movie. And so there's not room for anybody else but who you're seeing on screen in that. But in something like this, you know, they're constantly tearing down that plot and tearing down that story and just kind of tearing up everything. And so it's just this anarchy, you know, comes out of that. And that seems to be the most freeing part, is that whenever you break down what you think is supposed to be the plot, what's supposed to be the story, what you're supposed to follow, that allows you to have like all of this complete open space. And afterwards, Nathan, I was thinking about kind of our discussion we had on the Patreon show about Cinema of Attractions, and just kind of the, it felt like you're completely breaking down all of that and just feeling around to see what works from sequence to sequence. And this seems like the ramped up 100%, maybe 150% version of any of the examples that we gave in that episode.
Yeah, I feel like it is very much like saying, you know, just giving a sort of middle finger to like the last several decades of Hollywood of just sort of insistence on narrative over a pure attraction, over sort of like pure emotional and physical titillation. And it's just sort of saying like, forget that, forget the story stuff, forget all of those tropes and plot lines, and like, let's just get back to the pure feeling and sensation, and like, let's just like tickle people in their seats again. I mean, it feels like that, like Eisenstein quote about like wanting to put bombs under people's seats and to like shock them into paying attention. Obviously, it's not really like doing that ideologically necessarily, but just in the sort of how bold it is, it really feels like here is like everything that you can possibly do with like pop film. Here are all of here's all the potential that, you know, Hollywood could be doing. And
if I can say one thing quick,
alas, you know.
Hello?
No, go ahead.
Just quickly, I do know during the Broadway show they did electrify some of the seats, so they did shock some of the audiences.
That does not surprise me at all.
Yeah, I don't think Eisenstein was anticipating Hell's a Poppin' when he was talking. He was writing about that.
I'm sure he would have loved it if he'd seen it.
Absolutely. Well, it is. It's like you could follow along with the romance plot of this movie, but you're not going to remember the beats of that. But you'll definitely remember the bear and the tree, you know, laughing at you. I mean, that's what you're gonna yeah. That's what you're gonna remember from the from movies, not the story that's in place. Any kind of final thoughts on Hell's a Popping as we wrap up? I think that we've kind of given it a massive recommendation, but just anything else that kind of that the movie left you thinking about after watching it?
I think I'll just say, I think it's, again, it's such a surprising film in the way that it sort of just really unexpected expectations, really, which of course is a, you know, joke within itself. But I think it does, you know, continually tries to break you, I think, as Nathan said, out of the molds of comfort in so many ways, and the pleasure that it takes in some of that. And I think, again, like, it's not like every single gag possibly works, but it tries so hard to make every single gag work. And I love that it just tries, you know, so many different types of gags, whether like it's visual within the mise-en-scene. I think about like when they create that amazing was it the lighter for Bisha Auer to light his cigarette, and it's this huge gigantic thing, or the things where of course they're breaking, like, you know, the film strip where they're stuck halfway up and down. And of course, again, this is something audiences would have been highly familiar with, is like the film strip is in the wrong place, the projectionist needs to fix it. They're just not used to characters commenting on that fact in a way. And like, so I think, you know, and one of the things I'm always thinking about is like, in the ways that we talk about what audiences are historically in a lot of ways, and the idea is often in the way that audiences are rubes, right? That they didn't know better at the time because they weren't, you know, progressive enough or what have you. They wouldn't be smart enough, in the way that the modernist film traditions of Godard and Fassbender and what have you that followed in the 60s, 70s represent smart filmmaking. And I think what a film like this shows is audiences were very, very smart and sophisticated and could easily, you know, take pleasure in all sorts of types and tricks. And I think that's one of the things that I really take away from Hell's a Poppin', is like the sort of the intelligence it trusts on its audience in a lot of ways to follow it into the bizarre. And that's, I think, one of the true pleasures of the movie.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a lot of that, those kind of small moments of just breaking whatever you would perceive that I found to be so exhilarating about this. Like, there's so many small things. I mean, you even have like the part very early on when they're in the hell scene, and Olsen and Johnson want to rewind the tape, and so they rewind the film and they have the taxi cab that comes and falls down, but they want to completely redo the sequence, so they rewind it back, and then the taxi cab falls again, but this time it has the guy on top of the horse. And it's just like it's these things that I think kind of go a lot in line with, you know, the early, you know, film directors, somebody like a Georges Méliès, where it just kind of has this dream logic and kind of and completely feels like what you're seeing on screen doesn't seem to line up with what you think should be happening because of the limitations of film. And it's another example of that, that I was just like, I can't believe that. It doesn't have like that devout following outside of, you know, having to look for it on YouTube. Nathan, Miranda, any final thoughts?
All I will say is that it commits to the bit like few movies I've ever seen.
And to that, I would say for people who are listening or thinking about watching it, like, make sure you have, you know, the energy to stick with it, like, because it's very enjoyable. But like, if you're not in the mood and you could, you know, you're kind of tired, I think you could easily fall off, because like, you have to be with it all, like, what, 120 or not 120, but like 82 minutes of it, which it can seem a little long at times. But I do want to say too what you said, Zach, about you know, rewinding the film. And I think it's interesting, and like, with, you know, in that tradition of Méliès and early on, like, this idea that film is like, and maybe we've discussed this already, and like, I apologize, so maybe I'm slow, but how like, film is malleable. It doesn't have to, it, like, even after the fact, it doesn't have to follow in this strict linear plot for, you know, trajectory. It's, you know, you can interact with it. Yeah, that's just, I really like that point. So
No. There are few movies I feel like that, I mean, of any era, that I feel like really take that sort of the fluidity and flexibility of film, like, at its full face value, like this movie does. It really just like explores every possibility.
Yeah. I can't say that I laughed constantly at it, but at the same, I was completely riveted and was marveling at it the entire time. There was just parts where, even though I guess they were technically jokes that were on screen, I was just like, this is amazing. I love every part of this. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. And as we mentioned before, this Hell is a Puppet is available on YouTube. So if you've not seen it, it's 80 minutes, and I recommend checking it out. But thanks again for coming on and talking about this.
Oh, absolutely. It was a delight. Thank you so much.
And that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies that we talked about in this episode. And check us out on Patreon. We're going to have a film theory and show coming up very soon. But big thank you to our patrons, the Kittiest of Kittens, Joe Jordan, Pedro Seraphim, Hell Yeah Small World, Titus Arthur, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Chad Newsom, Maggie, Ron Hayes, Cam, Tyler Chandler, Whitney Rio Ross, and Matthew Lingo. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, folks, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1948 Spring in a Small Town. So we'll continue the series. If you have not been keeping up so far, please check back. We have Seventh Heaven was our first episode, followed by Metropolis, then The Black Cat, and The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum, all preceding Hell's a Poppin'. And if you go to cinematary.com, we have the rest of the lineup. So if you're a new listener checking in for the first time, be sure to look at that and check out the rest of the series. Until next week, thank you guys for listening.